Welcome to the Actionable Futurist podcast, a show all about the near-term future with practical and actionable advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and actionable futurist Andrew Grill.
Today's guest is Nick Abrahams, who is a corporate technology lawyer based in Sydney for Norton Rose Fulbright. Nick is the global co-chair of the firm's digital transformation practice. Nick regularly advises on tech, M&A, IT procurement and data privacy and cybersecurity matters, and also assists in-house counsel teams with innovation projects. He's involved heavily in the technology sector as a lawyer, advisor, non-exec director, entrepreneur and investor. Nick is coming to us today from my old hometown of Sydney, Australia. Welcome, Nick.
Hi, Andrew.
I'm going to get you to be very concise on some of the things today. We're talking about some big topics. I want to kick off with things around Web3, the metaverse, NFT, crypto. We follow each other on LinkedIn. Even this morning, I woke up to even more news. Let's just break it down. We're going to hit you with some terms, and I'm going to get Nick at the top of the show to give us a one or two sentence response to what these things are. Then we're going to dive deeper. So let's start with the big one, Web3. What is it in a sentence or two?
Web3, if we think about it, we've got that you can read the internet, you can write to the internet, but also you can own things on the internet. So you can own digital things, and also our experience of the internet will be embodied. So we'll move from two dimensions to three dimensions.
Metaverse.
So the metaverse is really just social media sites, but in sort of three dimensions. It'll be an embodied experience of social media.
NFT.
Non-fungible tokens is a way of owning digital things.
Cryptocurrency.
Is the tokenization of everything where both money but also assets can be reduced to tokens and are transportable electronically via distributed ledgers.
Blockchain.
Is really just a series of databases that are all connected and they prove transactions.
DeFi.
Decentralized finance. It's basically doing all the traditional things that a traditional bank would do, lending and savings and so forth, but doing it with cryptocurrency in a decentralized way. So there's no middleman.
And a nice segue to the last one, DAO.
The Decentralized Autonomous Organization. A lot of people describe this as the company of the future. Conceptually, it's more like a partnership with people who are members of it and who have voting rights in relation to what it's going to do.
So that was a high-level look, and I think it's a challenge sometimes to condense down into a sentence or two these huge concepts. And just talking off-air, your title is about digital transformation, and I'm sure your clients, my clients, many of them are still struggling with the transformation, getting their things online, getting the website to work properly. The challenge, I think, is we're asking people to delve into this metaverse, go into this new challenging world when they're still fixing the problems that are still there. We'll go into that. Let's look at those terms one by one. Let's start with Web3, because I think a lot of people, and I want to get your view on this, they group all of these new things into Web3. You know, one of your talk topics is Web3, the 3 trillion reasons to learn more about cryptocurrency and metaverse. You talked in your description about Web1 being read-only, Web2 being read and write. So Web3, let's go into more detail. What's the difference and why should people care about Web3?
The two key changes that Web3 bring about is the ability to own digital things. So if we think of Web1 and Web2, it's been fantastic for the democratization of content. So we can have, you know, 1,000 or 1,000,000 PDFs of something or JPEGs of something, and they can be transported around at no additional cost. But we are unable to establish ownership of any of those digital files. Whereas what Web3 gives us through NFT technology is the ability to actually be able to say, you know what, I own that particular digital file, and that's recorded on the blockchain for all to see. So I think there's that ownership, which is really, you know, if we want to see where the big opportunities are coming from, it's out of gaming. We can talk about that a little bit more detail. It's also our interactions with the internet are now going to be quite different as we move from what is a two-dimensional experience of the internet, whether you go shopping, et cetera, to a three-dimensional experience where you will, via a variety of technologies, whether it's virtual reality, augmented reality, other types of things, You will experience the internet in a three-dimensional way. So shopping will no longer necessarily be, you know, clicking on an image of something and it going into a virtual shopping cart, but the experience will be one of actually being engaged within the interface and grabbing things and putting them into what feels like an actual shopping cart.
And for some people listening today, there might be, well, I don't need the third dimension just yet. And so I think that's why there is some friction in an understanding and conceptualizing what this is. And for some people, let's call them Gen Y, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, this is completely normal. But for people more our age, they're like, we don't need the third dimension. When we talk Web3, is it really an all-encompassing? So could we put NFT, crypto, blockchain, could we put them, roll them up to Web3? Is that a fair assumption or is that being too general?
Web3 is the umbrella term for cryptocurrency, decentralized finance, NFTs, and metaverse. That's sort of become a convenient shorthand for it.
Some experts expect that by 2030, there may be as many as 5 billion users of the metaverse, and this giant ecosystem will nurture an economy of its own. So where do you stand on that view?
You know, you're quite right. Most of us can't really understand why people would spend time in things like Decentraland and Sandbox and those other standalone metaverse platforms, because it just doesn't seem that attractive. And we've done it before. So we had Second Life. You know, it was essentially the same sort of visual experience more than a decade ago, and that failed. So things have changed now. And I think they've changed largely because you can now own things in these metaverse lands. So if we look at how this all started from gaming, traditionally, it was the case in gaming, whether you're playing Fortnite or Axie Infinity or Roblox. It used to be the case that when you made, you know, you would buy something. So if you wanted to level up, as they call it, and buy a new sword or buy a new suit of armor, a skin, as they call it, you paid the money to the operator of the game. And then, you know, whilst ever you played the game, fine, you had an asset that you could use in game. But the minute you left the game, that asset was worthless to you. Whereas now what we've got with the metaverse is there is this entire secondary economy, so that within these games now, and indeed within Decentraland and Sandbox, is people can set up businesses actually creating new skins for you. So they sell you those skins as an NFT, or they sell you that sword as an NFT. And then you can trade that sword, and then you can also earn cryptocurrency within the game. So that's where it all becomes really enticing. I mean, you know, the actual experience of Second Life was, you know, it really tapped out at going to a virtual disco and having your avatar sort of dance as awkwardly as I dance in real life, but in a virtual world. So there wasn't that much driving it. Whereas what we've got with the metaverse is the ability for people and organizations to create businesses on top of a platform and make money and create experiences for people.
You mentioned Second Life. Just before we started recording, I went to re-download Second Life. I wanted to see how the experience had changed because I played with it back in 2003 when my computer was a lot slower and the graphics weren't as cool. I walked down the large jetty, which is the first time you go in there. I'd set my avatar up and walked around. I was underwhelmed after about 35 seconds. So I'm probably the wrong generation. But I think the way to get into, put our metaverse clothes on metaphorically and understand what it means is, you're right, around gaming and owning things. I suppose the leap for corporates listening to this podcast is, so I'm not a gamer. I'm someone that sells pharmaceuticals. So how am I going to exist in the metaverse? And we'll go on maybe a bit later on to the legal implications. How can corporates listening to this go from gaming to e-commerce and selling things that they have physically in their stores?
I mean, let's start with gaming, and then we'll talk about sort of who have been the first movers in this space. So if we look at gaming, that's where the more advanced metaverse business models are coming from. And so there's the concept of play-to-earn gaming, and Axie Infinity is one of the great examples. You can earn cryptocurrency, so consequently it's called play-to-earn, and you can earn a significant amount such that in places like the Philippines, there are now people whose job it is to just play Axie Infinity and earn cryptocurrency. And these aren't elite gamers. These aren't sort of, you know, your super e-gamers, as they're called. These are just normal people who've taken a shine to it and play it. And so they can earn cryptocurrency. And they're, in many cases, earning double the average wage. You've got your first metaverse worker there. And then we've got this concept now in gaming of what's called guilds. And so what happens if you want to go into one of these games, and there's more than Axie Infinity, there's a lot of play-to-earn games. If you want to go into one of these games, you need to acquire the necessary NFTs in order to be able to be competitive in the game. So you need to acquire, you know, the specific skin or the sword or whatever it is, the you know, the potions, etc. So you have to acquire those, but that's quite expensive. So to start off being remotely competitive in Axie Infinity is about a $2,000 proposition, which for folks in the Philippines, for example, you know, they don't have $2,000 to drop on starting in a game. And so what they do is they rent the NFTs from these so-called game guilds. And so what you've then got is a very familiar business model. Organizations, these game guilds that own assets, that rent those assets out and receive payments. So you can actually do a traditional sort of discounted cash flow against it. So that's what's growing up in gaming. And that's what we'll see come over into the real world. If we look at who's embraced the metaverse, and I think probably the better way to think of this is to think of NFTs first and who's embraced NFTs and then think about the metaverse. But we'll talk about the metaverse. Nike, they've got a very big proposition in the metaverse. And, you know, you go in there, you can do a whole range of different games and so forth. And there's also, you know, you can buy a whole range of digital assets for your avatar. So you can buy Nike shoes, et cetera, et cetera. And so we've seen that as a big area. So the first off were the fashion labels. So the Dolce & Gabbana's, Prada's and so forth. So they've all got significant propositions, significant metaverse propositions. So fashion's been very big, how you dress your avatar. And then the fast followers have been sports and the sporting brands. And then now we're starting to see beverage. So Miller Lite is a big land where you can, you know, go and sort of drink in a metaverse bar. And there's sort of things that happen, opportunities that arise in real world as you do that. And then McDonald's have just lodged some patents, which would allow you as you cruise through the metaverse to order your McDonald's. And then that would actually be delivered to you in real life. I don't think I've 100% convinced you or anyone that this is a fantastic experience right at the moment if you're not in the world already or if you're not under 26. But, you know, I think what we're starting to see is that these worlds are starting to really collide. And, you know, particularly as that younger demographic gets older, they're very used to a gaming type experience. And ultimately, the reason why Facebook is now called Meta and they're investing so much money is that our social media experience will be replaced by a metaverse social media experience. And that's, gamers do a lot of social networking within a game. And so that's why Facebook is so scared, because they face a genuine existential crisis as a result of this move out of traditional social media.
Nice segue, because I want to talk about Facebook. They actually changed their name to Meta Platforms. They paid a bank, I think, $40 million for the brand. So who should we believe when we hear about the metaverse? If you believe the Mark Zuckerberg Facebook Meta world, we'll all be wandering around with headsets. I encourage my clients to become digitally curious. So what you're talking about, I absolutely agree with, but I've never been a real gamer. However, if you look back to sort of 1994, 1995, when universities had the internet and I was playing around with it, then 1988, 1999, you could dial up to the internet. Back then, probably thought, we won't really need to be doing much with this. I actually have a video of me on George Street in Sydney in 2000 on a WAP phone scrolling through CNN News thinking, this is the future. But I think you and I, we are pioneers in this space, because while we may not be living and breathing it, I mean, I don't see you with a gaming headset on a gaming chair because you're a lawyer, maybe you're doing your part-time. I think we need to be curious. Back to my Facebook question, who should we believe? Are we being brainwashed by Facebook's view of the metaverse? This is the way it's going to be. We're going to meet Zuckerberg as an avatar. Who should we believe other than you when we're hearing about the metaverse?
I think the metaverse is it's a slow burn. I mean, I don't think we're flipping over into sandbox tomorrow. If you're a gamer, fine. You're already in that world. That's going to grow, and as the gaming community grows older and so forth. I think there's a natural growth out of that. In terms of what happens with those that aren't in the gaming community, there needs to be a reason to draw you into the metaverse. So Snoop Dogg has a land in Sandbox. So I don't want to live next to Snoop Dogg in real life. I don't want to live next to Snoop Dogg in Sandbox, but someone paid $1 million to get the house next to Snoop Dogg in Sandbox. So there are some people who do it. And I think for the crypto natives, they get it because this NFT proposition really becomes quite compelling. And NFTs have developed as a digital asset class. And so in order to show those off, you need, you know, you want people to experience that inside a metaverse type experience. So I think that will help to drive it. But I think for people who aren't crypto natives or gamers, I think it's going to be quite slow. And I don't think anyone's saying that, you know, this is going to flip overnight. I think that Mark Zuckerberg would love for Facebook to stay exactly the way that it is. I think, you know, that would be fantastic. But what he has recognized is that they've got declining user numbers and, you know, a whole range of Discord and a whole range of other social media platforms that are chipping away, and he's losing that younger generation. It's critical to any major brand to ensure that they attract and retain sort of younger generations, because they obviously become older and spend.
I have seen some corporates trying to jump onto the metaverse NFT crypto bandwagon. You remember not long ago, Kodak tried to rebrand themselves around Bitcoin. You've had whole companies based on Bitcoin and they wanted to get the bragging rights. You published a LinkedIn post today that Deloitte have just announced the opening of their smart factory in Decentraland. PricewaterhouseCoopers bought some land there in January, and KPMG has bought crypto to hold onto its balance sheet as part of a treasury diversification strategy, and has also bought a high profile NFT. So I can understand these thought leaders being the first to try these platforms, being digitally curious. But I'm sure, as I said in the intro, many of our clients are trying to work out how to just to transform digitally. What things should they be thinking about before jumping into the metaverse in terms of IP, regulation, branding, customer service? As a lawyer, and as a very savvy tech lawyer, what are you advising them in terms of the legal minefields with Web3, metaverse and NFTs?
I think it's fantastic that folks like Deloitte and KPMG and PwC are having a go, because I think that they do need to be involved in the ecosystem. You can't advise on something unless you're part of it and you understand the ecosystem. And I don't think any of those folks are saying, you know, we're going to make a fortune out of this. And, you know, the Deloitte one was, you know, was interesting because it's a smart factory. So the idea is that clients can go in there and experience what VR can do for manufacturing. And VR, virtual reality, is, you know, can do great things for manufacturing and remedial maintenance and so forth. So there's great opportunities there. So I think no one's punting the balance sheet, punting the whole company, that this is going to be the way out. But I think there's absolutely enough interest there from this two big client bases that I see that we represent, and I'm sure it's the same for KPMG and PwC and so forth. So you've got your fast growth, early stage crypto or metaverse or NFT companies. And those businesses are really important because they are growing an extraordinary clip. I've had two meetings with two separate founders over the last month or so, where they both talked about expectations of 1,000x return. So 1,000 times your money. Andrew, you and I come from a time during .com where if you could get 10x, you thought that was a great outcome. Well, now they're talking about 1,000x, and there are businesses around that have had 1,000x outcome in the crypto space, and they're legit businesses. So I can't say that's not a potential reality. It is possible, not likely for many organizations. But what that means is that there's a significant group of companies that are growing and that, you know, need to be serviced. So there's a lot of opportunity in that, where we're getting very significant companies growing. And I just spent the last couple of days looking at the tokenomics of a token issuance. And so what happens now, if you're a crypto style company or a token based company, so an NFT related company, then you have three asset classes effectively. You've got cash that you may have, you've got your shares, and now you've got the tokens that you can produce. And those tokens are sort of quasi equity in some way. They're like shares. And so you then need a whole schedule of what we call tokenomics, which says, you know, what can the company do with those, with tokens when they're minting new tokens? the other reasons why folks like, you know, our shop and, you know, PwC, KPMG need to be across this stuff is the big organizations are all trying to figure out how they should be in Web3. So you look at, you know, Tesla and Block, they've, you know, they're all, they've been acquiring crypto to hold on the balance sheet as a, you know, as corporate treasury diversification. You've got, you know, Starbucks and Microsoft accepting crypto payments. You've got to understand how that stuff works. You've got Samsung and HSBC opening in the metaverse. So we have to be part of it. And so that's sort of why it's important. And in terms of the legal, there's a few wacky cases. My favorite one right at the moment, there's a case of an artist created the Meta Birkin. It's a furry digital representation of the Birkin handbag. And as you could imagine, Hermes, who make the Birkin handbag, were not super excited that, you know, the normal Birkin sells for 10,000 US and the Meta Birkin sells for 42,000 US. So they weren't happy, so they brought an action. And interestingly, the artist is claiming its freedom of artistic expression and drawing parallels with Andy Warhol's soup cans. The legal issues, I talked about tokenomics. We've never had to look at that before. Now we have to become experts in how that all works. And then, you know, things around the IP. Lots of quite novel legal concepts being tested.
Brings me to regulation. So I'm wondering the judge or the legal entities that are arbitrating that dispute with the Meta Birkin, other than listening to this podcast and reading all the things you're doing, how do they come up to speed to understand? I mean, you're doing the right thing as a tech-savvy lawyer. As new things come up, you immerse yourself in it. But for your colleagues, for those listening that are in the legal fraternity, how can they possibly come up to speed to arbitrate something that is a very, very esoteric concept?
Everyone has to change. And so we've changed as well. So we're a law firm, we're a big global law firm. We're also got a significant consulting business. So a lot of what I'm doing these days, you know, there's legal and then there's the consulting aspect of it. So it's sort of consulting with organizations going into Web3 and sort of it sort of morphs out of legal into pure consulting. The judges are just extraordinary. We've had this question forever, which is, oh, how does a judge who is of a certain age understand the internet? And that was always thrown about that they'd never understand it. Judges are incredibly intelligent people. They do a lot of study of things. They have, I think, very curious minds and so are fascinated by things. And they get up to speed. And, you know, judges at the end of the day are really being educated as well by the lawyers who appear before them who explain the issues. And because it's an adversarial environment will get the issues brought to raise a sharp focus. So I've never been one to have a problem with judges not being up to the task technically. This is harder than the internet was to understand. Certainly the issues associated with how crypto works and then the speed of development of crypto and the different things that are happening, particularly in decentralized finance, that becomes very complicated very quickly for people who want to participate in that world. But I think with judges, they get a reasonable amount of time to get up to speed on things. And so I think they're good. The bigger problem is how do you regulate things like NFTs? And NFTs are not protected. They're not an asset class in the same way that shares are and so forth. So there's no proper regulation around how they are made available or distributed to the public. And so what we see is quite a lot of fraud associated with that.
Back to the regulators, I had the fortune of speaking to all of the governors of the European Central Banks late last year. I was on a closed session and they are grappling with the issue of digital currency and NFTs and they want to be playing in that space. And they were really looking to people like me and my esteemed panel of what do we do? Where do we go for information? So it's good to see they're up there. A lot to get through. I want to move on to NFTs now. And I really enjoyed watching your COVID isolation project, your NFT Price is Right game show. I'll drop a link in the show notes. It was a bit of fun, but it really sharpened the focus on what these are. You gave some great examples of the different types of NFTs, and maybe you can run through them now for our audience.
Most people can't fathom why are NFTs worth so much, because all we see is the headline number, you know, this particular NFT sold for $10 million. And at the end of the day, it's a digital file. Often it's a JPEG. And the idea that a JPEG alone is worth $10 million seems impossible. What I've done is to split it into six categories. So the first category, which is the hardest one to understand, is what I call Flex Club NFTs. They're things like Bored Apes or CryptoPunks. And people are paying millions of dollars for these. And there's something very specific about these. So think about, why do NFTs exist? So I've got a theory that they've actually been created by the cryptocurrency community. Many or a number of people have made a lot of money out of cryptocurrency, like a lot of money. And it's all sitting in crypto, but that's a non-performing asset. So they've needed to, in effect, create an asset class. And that's what NFTs are. So they're digital assets that people can invest in. So I feel like it's an outpouring of the fact that there's just so much money that people don't want to convert into US or Aussie dollars because, you know, they may not want to pay tax on it, etc. So you've got these concepts of NFTs. First one, Flex Club NFTs. There's a limited number of them, usually 10,000. So they've got this concept of provable scarcity. They have additional benefits to them. So you might get, you know, free NFT drops in the future. So think of that like a dividend stream from a share. They offer access to VIP event where you can hang out with like-minded crypto folks. So a little bit like a sort of fancy crypto country club. You know, let's not forget the basic humanity of it all, which is these are people who've made a lot of money out of crypto. And so they would like to show off how much money they've had. So, you know, in the real world, it might be a green Lamborghini, but in the digital world, if you own a Bored Ape or a CryptoPunk, that's a sign that you've really made it. And that's what's called digital flexing. So we've got Flex Club NFTs. Then we've got art NFTs. There was an artist called Beeple who previous to NFTs had only sold a print for $200. And then last year sold a piece of digital art as an NFT for $69 million. All I can say about that is art and, you know, people pay a lot of money for contemporary art that, you know, others might think it's not very hard to create or not worth that much, but people will pay, you know, tens of millions of dollars. So I think art, it's one of a kind. We just put that to one side and say that art is art. And if the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and if that beholder just happens to have enormous amounts of crypto, that's a great time for the artist. Then got the most exciting area, I think, is collectible NFTs. This becomes understandable, particularly with sports memorabilia. So we've always had sports trading cards. And now what we've got is those trading cards have been digitized. And so the US National Basketball Association has been the standout winner with an NFT drop called Top Shots. And so more than $700 million worth of Top Shots, which are literally just little couple of second video clips of basketball, big basketball moves, have sold in the last year. And the great part about that is every time one of those Top Shots gets on sold, the NBA gets 5%. And literally every sporting code in the world is in the NFT game, that collectible game. Then getting through them, twinning NFTs. So this is where you get a digital twin of your real world purchase, very popular in the luxury goods market. So Dolce & Gabbana just sold 9 suits for $6 million. And the hook was that you received an NFT twin of that suit so that your avatar could wear the same suit online. And Alfa Romeo just released the first ever car with an NFT logbook. We then got gaming NFTs. So I talked about the idea of buying the skins or the swords. That's very popular. And then finally, where we've seen, you know, literally there's over 100 of the world's biggest brands have minted their own NFTs in the last 6 months. And so that's where you can actually do a significant amount of community building with your brand by minting NFTs. And think of that as an extension of the loyalty program. So you give a particular NFT of, you know, whether it's a Nike NFT or a Samsung NFT, and you make that available to community, and then they get benefits as a result of that.
Really interesting different NFT asset classes. And you mentioned the Bored Apes. I read a story on the weekend about a pop-up restaurant called the Bored Ape Restaurant. It's a pop-up. And if you have a certain type of Bored Ape, you actually get some free meals. But the kicker was they don't take cash, obviously. They only take ape coin. But when you pay for the ape coin, between ordering it and then getting the burger, the value of the coin has changed. And also you have to pay a gas fee to actually complete the transaction. It actually costs the person more in normal money than it would normally to buy a hamburger. But apparently they're actually very good hamburgers. So that's a great thing.
There's been a surprising number of those sort of hospitality flex club, that sense of, you know, a VIP access that you get something special. The idea of paying gas fees, which can be incredibly expensive, just doesn't appeal to me necessarily. But, you know, there's clearly a market.
So one good use case I saw is ticketing. So I've been to a few concerts here in London and I've dealt with the authorised ticket outlet, but there are a number of secondary ticket selling services that have fallen foul of all the regulators because they charge very large prices. There's one I saw was actually on a London Underground billboard, so this is me going mainstream, called SeatLab NFT. And I went to their website and they're talking about how they're going to issue tickets in NFTs. Now, I can see about it being collectible, but it couldn't be unique. And obviously, if it's stored on a blockchain, it's irrefutable. So are those sort of use cases where we might break out of the gaming into the real world and actually solving real world problems like ticket touting?
It's a great use case. So if you look at Coachella Music Festival this year, they did their ticketing by NFT. The Super Bowl was all ticketed by NFT tickets. And in fact, the US football folks, so they sold 250,000 tickets as NFTs last year and intend to grow that this year. So ticketing is a great use case for NFTs. And it solves two problems. You know, one is, of course, proving that you've got the correct ticket. And then the other one is, you know, people love to collect tickets to significant events. So, yeah, I think tickets are going to be important. There's got to be some utility to it. Like, I don't think it works necessarily just for, you know, say a museum to do NFT tickets. There has to be more utility to the tickets these days. So one-off big events, yeah, okay, that's a good one. Or if you, you know, if you love your particular team, that's a reason to collect the tickets. But I don't think just because you ticket people necessarily means you need to be in the NFT game.
So you talked about the big numbers, and there's one example I want to pull up. Crypto entrepreneur Sina Estavi bought Twitter founder Jack Dorsey's first ever tweet as an NFT for $2.9 million last year. It ended up with a top bid of just $280. He then listed the NFT for sale again at $48 million. What went wrong here, and why are these prices so ridiculous?
That's widely regarded as being, you know, maybe that's the sort of harbinger of the NFT bubble bursting. I'm not sure that's the case because we've had, you know, a number of significant NFT drops since then that have, you know, raised more than, you know, a couple of $100 million. So I don't think it necessarily means that, you know, the whole NFT thing has been proven to be, you know, just a complete sham and a bubble. It does show that you've got to be careful what it is that you're buying and what is the value to it. So if it's art, then it's art. And I think any art collector will tell you, irrelevant what you pay for the art, you must buy the art because you love the art. If you're buying it as an investor, then that's a dangerous proposition. The fact that no one was prepared to bid, you know, more than a couple of hundred dollars seems unusual. And, you know, one thing we need to be careful about with the NFT world too is there's a lot of what's called wash trading, where people are selling NFTs to themselves, driving up the price. It's not necessarily a fair or level playing field out there with NFTs. I don't think that means that the NFT world is going to collapse, but it does mean that people should absolutely be on notice that, you know, be very careful what you buy.
You mentioned the sporting uses, and back in your part of the world, the Australian Football League or the AFL had a recent balls up, pun intended, with something they were doing. They left a Discord server open. So what should corporates and companies be doing to get into the NFT world securely and safely?
Very few organisations, and I say probably none, have the capacity to execute on a significant NFT drop internally. So there's the technology layer, which in many respects is actually relatively simple. There's a whole range of already existing smart contracts out there and platforms that you can use. So technically you could, you know, you could possibly do it yourself. What's critical is NFTs don't just sell because they're great. You know, the Bored Apes didn't sell because they're great pieces of art. I mean, there's nothing to the artwork. They sold because there was a community developed around them. And so with organizations that are looking to get into the NFT world, you need good advisors around how to build a community that's going to support that NFT. And that's where Discord becomes very important. So Discord, which most people will not know what Discord is. If you're a gamer or a crypto native, you'll understand Discord. It's a very popular social media platform for those folks. And then crypto Twitter is the other area, and that's normal Twitter, but it's just folks who concentrate on crypto related postings. And so that's how you build your community. It's a pretty fickle community in a sense that if you don't know what you're doing or you get something wrong, which is what happened with the poor old AFL, then the community is pretty quick to react. And yeah, the AFL unfortunately didn't manage their Discord channel correctly, and so they got bad reactions from that. But that's why if you're an organization that's getting into this, it's generally coming from the marketing team. But the marketing team saying, you know what, we need to be in the NFT world. So it's generated by marketing, but you need good advisors on how to build a community, good technical advice, you know, good legal and consulting advice.
It'd be remiss of us not to talk about security and specifically cybersecurity around here, because you've got all this money, this value, and every day I hear about wallets being hacked and exchanges being hacked. And I read yesterday about an Instagram account that was hacked and then something was put up and people were then forced to buy things and they lost lots and lots of money. My 101 public service announcement around cybersecurity is use a password manager, turn on two-factor authentication, check your credentials and have I been pawned. They're basic hygiene things. What do you need to do above and beyond that if you're playing in the crypto, NFT, Web3 world?
Those basic hygiene factors are fantastic. You should apply those across everything that we do. In the NFT world, there's a lot of what's called rug pulls that have happened, which is basically people promote these NFT projects and then people put their money in and then, you know, the NFT project never happens and who the promoter was. People are prepared to accept an eye-watering amount of risk in the NFT world. I think because the returns are so extraordinary. As I said, if you have a potential 1,000x return, you can accept a pretty high level of risk, and that's what people are doing. And so my advice would be, A, don't get into the NFT world unless you know an awful lot about it. I mean, you would have to spend 40 or 50 hours studying the NFT world to understand even the very beginnings as to why an NFT would be valuable. It's a harder asset class to pick than crypto. Crypto is hard enough, but at least with crypto, you know, you're investing in a fungible currency, so it'll always be worth some value. Whereas with an NFT, you know, it could be worth nothing. You've got to study it very, very deeply. A lot of people will invest in NFT projects where the promoters are anonymous. That's not something I would ever think of doing. I mean, we wouldn't do that in real life. We wouldn't sort of, you know, put money into something where we didn't know who was responsible for it, because the success of most of the NFT projects is largely derived out of A, who is the artist who's involved and have they got a following? Then, you know, if they've got a good following, then your chances are better. That'll be a good drop. And then who are the other promoters? Do they have a good reputation as well? I don't recommend just punting blindly. I think, you know, the team is critically important and looking at what they've done previously and reading the white papers, et cetera.
I feel like we're unpacking the Russian dolls, because we've talked a lot about crypto or cryptocurrency. And if I just rewind back to sort of 2017, when I started getting really interested in this, I tell the story that I sat next to someone at a Christmas party in London. I said, what do you do? And he said, oh, I'm a Bitcoin expert. I said, well, this is your lucky evening. I'm going to pump you for questions. A couple of things that I learned back then that really shocked me. First of all, Bitcoin was never designed as a currency. It's got a global transaction speed of 7 per second. If you compare that to Visa, that does about 65,000. And more recently, I learned a fact that for every one Bitcoin transaction, it uses the same amount of energy that you could do 1.2 million Visa transactions with. That's alarming when people don't know that. And to your point, you talked about a number of hours of educating yourself just about NFTs. You can probably do that and more on cryptos. What is the future of blockchain, Bitcoin, and distributed ledger technologies?
We need to recognize that, you know, Bitcoin was never intended to be, you know, a transactional currency. And its best analogy is digital gold, in that, you know, it's really a buy to hold proposition. There'll only ever be 21 million of them. There's currently mined about 19 million. So we're getting closer to the 21 million. It's not a transactional currency, but there's loads of other cryptocurrencies that are intended to be transactional currencies. And so they're the ones that we would look to in terms of being a cash type replacement, Ethereum or others. So you've got that. And then you've got the stable coins, which are linked to particularly the US dollar. So they're fascinating and they're a really important part of decentralized finance. The idea is that you take all the volatility out of the cryptocurrency, because it's just a currency that is pegged to the US dollar. So you could transfer it across the blockchain and it would be the equivalent of transferring US dollars across the blockchain, but you don't have all of the transfer fees and the intermediaries. Lots of good and interesting technology happening there. The energy usage is a massive issue. Bitcoin is not great for sure. It uses a lot of energy, as does Ethereum and a few of the other what's called proof of work cryptocurrencies. So what is happening is that there are solutions being devised which will move them away from being this proof of work concept, which sucks a lot of compute power, to doing other things. So I'm a believer that, you know, we will solve this, you know, in the next couple of years. The community has recognized that it's a massive issue, and it's a massive holdback on the ability of these currencies to have broad-based adoption. I believe in 5 years' time, we've got to look at this and say, do you believe that cryptocurrencies and digital assets will be a part of the ecosystem? And if you say you don't believe it, you know, just stay on the sideline and say it's not going to happen. If you look at the numbers, cryptocurrency is now between $2 and $3 trillion worth of value and growing incredibly fast. And that's only happened in the last, you know, 10 or so years. You've got NFTs, which went from in 2020, $13 million of value to $41 billion last year. And then you've got DeFi, which went from pretty much nothing to $200 billion last year. So to say that this is not going to be part of the landscape in 5 years, I think is pretty aggressive. And so my belief is that the digital assets and crypto will be part of the landscape in 5 years, but it's not going to be linear. There's going to be fraud. There's going to be losses. There's going to be technology issues. Ultimately, we got a new asset class for all of us. We need to be curious about it and try to understand how it works and how we can use it to benefit our businesses and indeed, you know, our customers.
I think the one thing we haven't factored, and we don't have an insight because we're not there, is what will central banks do? So that would be another thing that we need to factor in. What's the hottest thing in crypto that you're seeing at the moment?
Stablecoins are absolutely the hottest thing in crypto. So this idea that you can link a coin to the US dollar. So, you know, it was in effect the same as a US dollar, and that was US dollars actually verifiably held in a financial organization, a bank. That was where they started. And now you've got sort of crypto stable coins. So what they do is they over collateralize the coin. So that one, let's call it Luna, which is one of them, that one Luna has three Lunas deposited as collateral against them. So you can be comfortable that there's real value to it. It's trying to take out the volatility. And then you've got now what's called algorithmic stable coins, which, you know, just the maths on that blows my mind. So this has all happened in the last 6 months. So that's why I say this stuff is moving incredibly fast. What's exciting is, I think, stablecoins, and then I think tokenomics. We'll talk more about tokenomics. You'll hear loads more about tokenomics in the next year or so. I mean, I did my very first, and I think one of the first in this country at least, an employee token option plan where the employees of this particular company, rather than be given equity or shares, were given tokens. And they were super excited about that because tokens, as soon as they vest, can then be sold on a decentralized exchange. Whereas if you're just getting equity in an unlisted company, it's an illiquid asset. So yeah, tokenomics, I think, is the next big thing.
I agree. We're almost out of time. We could have a whole session on that. So maybe we'll come back and do that at some other stage. But before we run out of time, DeFi and DAO, you alluded to that there. Where will we see that play in the next few years?
Decentralized finance, I think it's going to be very significant. It's effectively a parallel banking system. There's a lot of smart money in it. I think they're getting quite sophisticated with the way that they are dealing with both transactions and also trying to take the risk out of that. So I think DeFi is interesting. DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. So people believe that this is an alternative to companies. You know, there are the sort of techno-utopian idealists who believe that these are all organizations that exist and everyone votes on everything. And I just don't think that that happens. And they vote because it's all done by technology. So, you know, if you've got a certain number of governance tokens, you get a certain number of votes and every decision has to be voted on. So anyone who's ever been involved in a partnership will know that everyone voting on everything is a very poor way of organizing any complex business. I don't think that's exceptionally going to work, at least as pure as that. But this concept of DAOs is very strong in the crypto community, and it will continue to grow. but I suspect it will start to morph into something that looks a lot more like a traditional corporate structure where you'll have power to make key decisions centralized in a few people, you know, very similar to what we have with traditional organizations, but certainly something to keep an eye out for.
How can listeners stay up to date with these fascinating topics, and how do you stay up to date?
You should definitely read a lot and podcast. Cointelegraph would be a great place for everyone to start. It's got a good across-the-board understanding of things. Look up crypto or metaverse in podcasts, or you could, you know, listen to my podcast. On LinkedIn, there's some good folks. Obviously, you know, Andrew, yours, my things. Everyone's posting some good things. And it's about engaging with the content and engaging with the community, asking questions. And you'll find that people are very excited to explain what's going on.
Nick, thank you so much for your time today. A fascinating discussion. I'm sure we'll talk more in the future.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Appreciate it. And thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Actionable Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at actionablefuturist.com. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favourite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops delivered in person or virtually at actionablefuturist.com. Until next time, this has been the Actionable Futurist Podcast.